Namaste and welcome. It's nice to see a big turnout today, even though we have all the sunshine. So it's good to see people here. Looks like we have a very short session again today. So that's fine too. My mind is grasping. This is something new. Anything to do about it other than letting it pass? Well, the thing is trying not to grasp onto the grasping, you know? Try not to focus on it, okay? Try not to focus on the grasping. And the things that are coming up, just look at it in a disinterested light. Okay. And this will take you more into a witness state. It's because when you start grasping, then what happens? You start becoming too much externalized again. Okay. And caught up. Caught up in these things. So just kind of watch it like the old video that you've seen one too many times. Okay. I think we did this last time. I think we answered this. Yeah, we answered this last week, so I don't know how that got in. When I go into deep kriyas, sometimes my inner voice tells me things about my past or future. Is this just my ego talking to mislead me, or is that your soul truth? Should we ignore that inner voice? Well, the thing is not to, you know, pay too much attention to it. You know, once again, don't get caught up in it. Yeah, some things will come forward, you know, from past, whatever. It's discharging. You know, some things could come up to, you know, maybe this could be possibly in the direction you're headed into in the future, whatever. It's like with psychic things, you know, if they pick up psychic things, they can tell you, well, the direction you're going, this is, you know, what might take place. But that can always be changed. One's not locked into anything. This is like when I'm doing the readings for people. If I do the tarot reading, what it is just looking at what's going on in your consciousness. What's there? What's been there? And the value in it is just to be able to see it a little more concretely, so then you can stop and begin to question it. That's all. Okay. But there are no readings done that are like, this is what's going to take place in your future, you know, and all of this stuff. No. It's just looking at what has been taking place in consciousness and some things that have been coming up, some things, you know, to start to question. That's all. And so that's it for the satsang bowl this morning. Very short. So I think we'll do a reading from one of the magazines this time. There were so many good ones, it's always hard to pick one. Okay, I think we're going to do today the power of solitude. And this is Shambhala Mountain Center's Reggie Ray talks to Tricycle's Ted Rose about the value of solitary retreat. Reginald A. Ray studied Buddhism as a divinity student at the University of Chicago, and in 1968, when he read Chogyam Trungpa's Born in Tibet, he realized Buddha Dharma could be more than an intellectual pursuit. He met Trungpa Rinpoche 2 years later and offered to drop out of divinity school and move to his Vermont retreat center. Trungpa said no, instructing Ray to finish his degree, to which the young man grudgingly agreed. Since then, Dr. Reggie Ray has become a respected scholar of Buddhism as well as a senior teacher in Trungpa's lineage. He teaches Buddhism at Colorado University and Naropa University and leads meditation retreats at Shambhala Mountain Center in Red Feathers Lakes, Colorado. He's published several scholarly books, including two authoritative volumes on the history, context, and practices of Tibetan Buddhism, entitled Indestructible Truth and Secret of the Vajra World. He spends at least 3 months of every year in solitary retreat. Isolated retreat is a crucial component of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and Reggie Ray may be the most vocal advocate for its utility in the modern Western context. Tricycle contributor Ted Rose spoke to Ray just before the teacher headed into isolated retreat in a wood cabin above Shambhala Mountain Center. Can we turn this off? It's getting a little warm. When I mention my own experience of going into isolated retreat for 10 days, most of my friends get a little suspicious. They think of another Ted who has spent time in a cabin alone. Ted Kaczynski, the so-called Unabomber. Why do people often have such negative impression of isolated retreat? We're very extroverted society. Even though within the Western tradition, the practice of seclusion and retreat are very much a part of our own spiritual culture. The contemplative practices of Roman Catholicism, for example, most people are not aware that they are part of our heritage. I think the other reason is that not only has the typical Western person spent little or no time alone, but many have an underlying fear of solitude. Possibly driving some of the misunderstanding of retreat is a deep-seated fear of being alone without distraction, without entertainment, without work, without other people around to constantly confirm our sense of self. We live in a culture driven by consumerism. Many of us feel, perhaps without realizing it, that unless we are producing in some sort of external, materialistic way, our legitimacy as a human being is somehow in question. We don't really see where retreat fits in. What are the essential qualities of an isolated retreat? Is it possible to do without any meditation experience? Many people who arrive at Naropa or up here at Shambhala Mountain Center have already had some experience of solitude. Without any real knowledge of retreat practice or even meditation, they've gone off into the woods or mountains in search of solitude. One of the things they often discover when they get into those situations is that they've brought their whole world with them. Their anxiety, their disturbing emotions, their mental speed, their mental preoccupations are just as present in solitude as they are in ordinary life. In fact, they may be even more prevalent. The problem is that they don't know what to do with their mind. Retreat combines solitude and the practice of meditation, where you begin to actually explore your own mind. What you find is that through intensive meditation and retreat, you begin to attend to your mind in a direct an unmediated way. Your mind begins to slow down. Your sense perceptions often open up. You find yourself increasingly present to your life, and you begin to experience solitude in a deep and genuine way. The environment is solitude, but the essential ingredient is meditation practice. What you actually do with your mind when you're alone, simply being in solitude, is not good enough. You mentioned the use of retreat practice in Roman Catholicism. Does that feature the same combination of solitude and meditation practice? Or is the structured meditation and retreat the unique offering from Buddhism? Both Buddhism and Roman Catholicism employ structured form practices and the formless practices of working with awareness itself. Father Thomas Keating, who runs the Benedictine Monastery in Snowmass, Colorado, teaches what he calls a centering prayer. My understanding is that this is very much a mindful discipline. Bringing the mind to a point and training it to be present, then allowing the inner wisdom to gradually unfold from that. If you look at other contemplative orders in Roman Catholicism, I think you'll see quite similar practices. Perhaps an important difference between Buddhism and Christianity is that within the Christian tradition, there is usually a subject you are contemplating. Whereas in Buddhism, especially with the formless practices, you are really opening the mind in and of itself. You are not contemplating a particular subject or figure. Ultimately, we are looking to simply open the mind and to lay bare its depths. In Christianity, you find that as well, but it's not an absolute difference, but a difference in emphasis. In the Buddhist universe, it seems like Tibetan Buddhism is the greatest champion of isolated retreat. Is that accurate? In the Western presentation of Buddhism, you do find that the Tibetan tradition is advocating solitary retreat more than the other traditions. But in Asia, within Zen and Theravada, you have a history of solitary retreat being very important. For example, today in all of the Theravada countries, in addition to the classic and conventional monasticism, there is a forest tradition. Within the forest tradition, monks live in isolation in the jungle, where they devote themselves to meditation all day and all night long. In the Zen tradition, if you look back at the beginnings, you will find the original Chan meditation and tradition was to a large extent a retreat tradition. These were people who also lived in the jungles and forests and practiced meditation in isolation. It was only later in the history of Chan that a more settled monastic tradition began to take precedence. In the Japanese tradition, Dogen, who lived from 1200 to 1253, studied Buddhism in Japan, and he wasn't very happy with what he found. It didn't seem like the true Dharma. He went to China and studied with a Chan master. When he came back to Japan, he established retreat centers in the countryside. Nowadays, Zen is more associated with practice in the Zendo and the community. But historically, solitary retreat has been very important. We've reached a point where people can see the value of practicing in a group, but have a harder time seeing the value of being up in a cabin alone. There's something uniquely powerful about meditating in a group. Discovering community and a depth of discipline that people may not have individually. In group retreat, the container is provided, a framework of discipline surrounds you, and you're actually able to engage a level of sustained practice that you might otherwise be incapable of. You begin to see a lot of your habitual patterns relating to others, and you begin to discover new ways of relating to other people. You learn to be with other people in silence. That is a huge discovery for people. So there are unique benefits from sitting together, especially for people in the early stage of practice. But something happens on solitary retreat that cannot happen in a group situation and certainly doesn't happen during individual practice at home. We see for ourselves that within each human being is the Buddha nature. What is the Buddha nature? It's a mind that's open and completely unencumbered. It's empty, and it gives birth to warm and compassion for other people. As doctrine, this can be very clearly explained, but it's another thing and very shocking to discover this within oneself. What solitary retreat practice provides that I don't think is possible in any other way is freedom from the distraction and the reinforcement and confusion of interpersonal relationships. So over a period of time, your mind is able to open up to a much greater depth than would otherwise be possible. We talk about living in the moment, but it's just a concept for most people. In retreat, you actually learn how to do it. In fact, it occurs naturally. This is why, you know, some of the Buddhist traditions they have where you go into retreat and they're committed to it for 3 years, three months, 3 days. And when they do this retreat, they don't even lay down at night. They sit in a sitting box for meditation. And the value is you have to confront yourself. There are no distractions to run away from yourself and the mind. Okay? So when you first get there, the mind's going to be going 1,000 miles a minute, looking for some kind of distraction. It can be hell at first. Because there's nothing to take your mind off of looking at the mind. Eventually, you have to start to turn inward and look. It's like when you're doing the Vipassana and you go and it's a 10-day. You're sitting there and you have to look at the mind. There are no other distractions in place. Okay. This is another reason we have the center here for people that want to come for silent meditation. Okay. They can come. We have the room that's in the back. You have your own area. Okay. Get you out of the environment you're in and come and just spend it in silent meditation for the most part. And then we'll do also some energy work with them, help to facilitate, accelerate things. Okay. But this is what, you know, the whole of the path is about. Kundalini as well. Kundalini, once it starts, what happens? All this stuff starts coming up to be looked at. So it's not about chasing cities and powers and all of these things. It's about finally stopping and looking at what holds all of this stuff into place and confronting it and cutting the knots of it. This is the path and the journey, no matter which way it's entered. Whether you have it because of Kundalini and you can't get away from the stuff coming up, or whether you go and you're in a retreat and you eventually have to confront the mind. Kundalini, it's a little harder to run away from the stuff that's coming up. Okay. In everyday life, it's a little easier to run away from it. Unless you happen to be in a solitary retreat. Then it will come up and you will. We'll see. Then you really got nowhere to go. Then you've really got to confront it. Yeah. Yeah. Because even if you're in Kundalini process now, you know you can still attempt to get yourself involved in so much work that you don't think you're not going to have to look at it. But and you can try to repress it for a time, but eventually it's going to start coming up again. So the more time you can spend in the solitary and just see this coming up and not be reacting to it, not trying to cover it over, not trying to, you know, run away from it, it gives you a chance to really look at it point blank and go to the source of it and cut the root. Okay. So what is the benefit of the kind of discovery of being in the moment? The full benefit is not really realized in retreat itself. The whole point of retreat is to develop your mind and state of being so that when you're living ordinary life, you are more present to yourself and to your life and to other people. You can look at retreat as a practice to develop compassion for other people. When you know how to relax into that deeper sense of yourself, you can be there for people in a way that you could never be before. In a way that's not driven by your ambition and habitual patterns, but rather where you see what other people really need. You see their experience from their side. You're actually able to get out of yourself. Far from being an antisocial practice, retreat practices frees you up to love people in a uniquely powerful way. Most of us would love to be kind to others, to be compassionate, and yet we're so tied up with our own hope and fear, our own emotions, and our own preconceptions that we just can't do it. Not really. Through retreat practice, we learn the pathway to the person we most long to be. Now let's step back a moment. What was your first retreat like, and how has your personal experience of retreat changed over the years? He says, well, my initial exposure to the concept came when I first met Trungpa Rinpoche in 1970. He'd just come to the retreat center, Tale of the Tiger, in northern Vermont, which is now called Karma Choling. He was talking about retreat practice. I saw that he was already sending people who had little meditation experience, into retreat. So I asked him, should I do a retreat? And he said, absolutely. And I said, well, I've never done one before, and I was thinking about doing a month. And he said, yeah, that's great. Sure, no problem. You could do it. Mm-hmm. Even though I'd never meditated in my life. So he had enormous confidence in retreat practice. He presented it as the heart of our Dharma. This is who we are. We are the Kagyu lineage, and we're practitioners, and we do retreats. It's the point of our whole life. So I planned a retreat. I did it in 1972 at Karma Choling. I didn't know what to expect. I had visions of peace and solitude and quiet and tranquility. During the first week, I discovered that I had the most agitated, chaotic, neurotic mind that I could have ever possibly imagined. My mind was insane. After 1 week, I couldn't take it anymore. Sitting in that little cabin, hour after hour, I said, I'm sorry, I just can't do this. And I made myself stay till the end of the week. And then I left. Actually, I left in the middle of the night, running down the hill in the dead of winter in my bedroom slippers and pajamas. I had to get out of there. This was my first experience. Not quite what he thought it was going to be. When I got out, though, I noticed my mind worked better. It was clearer. My sense perceptions were more steady. And I experienced a kind of openness to other people I'd never experienced before. And I realized that although the experience of my first retreat had been torture, the benefit of it was undeniable. So I planned my next retreat, which didn't happen for a year. But I actually did a whole month in a tent on a mountaintop in New Hampshire. Pretty much every year since then, I've done retreat. This summer, it's going to be about 3 months. and I'd like to eventually edge my way up to 6 months a year. As I get older, I'm 62 now, my stamina is becoming more of an issue. So I don't know how much longer I'll be able to go up on the mountain. There's a wonderful Kagyu saying, when we're young, we don't realize the importance of Dharma practice. When we're middle-aged, we think we're too busy to do it. And when we're old, it's too late. Now that I finally really realizing the tremendous, incalculable benefit of retreat, I'm approaching a time when I won't be able to do it physically. This realization is not a little heartbreaking. He said, do you find that your experience of retreat has changed over the years? Well, truthfully, the first many years that I did retreat were spent working with a mind that was virtually without cessation, really very speedy, very tied up with thinking about things. I started to see that maybe 90% of the time in retreat, my mind is in a very neurotic mode. And then there's this other thing, this depth of experience that seems to come out of nowhere. From the very beginning, I could tell that's where it was all heading. But I also realized it takes a very steady practice in order to cultivate that. You can't just meditate for a few days and expect to live in the Buddha nature. It takes a lifetime of practice to develop. But I've discovered that if you do the practice, the results manifest themselves. Now that's huge. This is not wishful thinking. Really undeniable and lasting transformation, that's what is at stake. That's what I try to communicate to my students. Number one, it takes work. Number two, it gets you to a place in your own life where maybe you really want to be more than anywhere else. So it's definitely worth doing. And so another reason we have the center here, for people to come and just sit. Just spend time in the silence. Well, it's great to come on Sundays and have community, have group meditation. It was great the other evening to come and have the bhajans and the chanting. That was great. We had a lot of fun. But also we need to spend the time for meditation and for solitude. Okay? Alone, without distraction. To look at really what's coming up. And then question, what is the source of this? What holds it in place? What's underneath of this? Because what cuts through, and what cut through for me, the journey of Kundalini, was self-inquiry. Okay? And self-inquiry only comes when we start really, really, really looking into the depths and the heart of this. What is this I? Is it the mind? Is it the emotion? All of these things come up, stem around what? I, me, my journey, my cognition, my wants, my desires, my aversions. Okay. My ecstasy, my bliss. It's all about my bliss. I'm chasing my bliss. So eventually we have to stop and confront it. At somebody online the other day, they were trying to impress me with their knowledge about non-duality. And when it got confronted, They became very angry. How dare you touch my belief systems? But they've helped me to progress so much. I said, they keep you happy in your little cage. You know, be willing to cut the bars of the cage. Yes. Sometimes this is Kali. She steps in and changes those belief systems, and life is going to confront it one way or another. Absolutely. This is where it takes understanding. It's the, you know, the value of having the symbology and having that. What is Kali? What is this? You know, it's facing the fears. It's facing whatever comes is for our benefit one way or another, to get us to look at it, to get us to look at these things. We can keep trying to put up blocks, but eventually, you know, life is going to hit you in the face where we have to look at it one way or another. Okay. And contrary to popular belief, it's not beating up on us. It's actually, you know, that left-handed blessing to get us to stop and to confront and finally get to the bottom of it. But we can keep trying to run away, and then it'll whack us harder each time. Get up and pick up and run again, and it whacks you again. Eventually, we have to look at it. You know, either that or we just get so freaking exhausted that we can't push it away any longer. So, the choice is ours. And then when we get to the end of it, it's just like we see that all the suffering we were having was due to our own ignorance and attempts to keep ourselves safe when there was really nothing that we needed to be safe from. And so on that note, we will go ahead and take a break, have some tea, and Jyoti Daya brought two big things of donuts. So please, everyone, eat lots of donuts so I don't have those things around this whole week. Take pity on me. Please eat donuts today. They could take doggy bags of donuts home, too. That would be fine, too. Yeah, enjoy, be happy, okay? And then we'll go ahead and reconvene and have some meditation. Thank you, namaste.